This session is one that we've done every year, and it's always popular and always full of information, which is Literary Agents 101. And those of you that were in the first session here this morning heard me say that it's not just about getting an agent, it's about getting the right agent, and we'll talk about that too. But we did start this morning looking at query letters, which is the first way that most of you will, as I said, touch an agent. And of course, I mean their hearts. But
please.
Some of you will also get to meet them at things like this, and if you
and
have,
you can
of
touch
course,
our hands.
You can touch their hands as well, yeah, if they're watched. And this is going to be mostly about your questions, but maybe we'll start with just a little chat, and let's introduce our agents. So I'm going to ask them both just to say a little bit about themselves. We have two particularly wonderful agents who both represent their own agencies as well, which is also pretty fantastic, two women doing it for themselves. Yeah. So let's start with Julie Bear.
Hi, I'm Julie Bear. Let's see. I got my start in publishing really by working at a bookstore downtown called Shakespeare & Company, which was a store that I loved and I used to shop in all the time. And finally, I was spending all my money there. And one day I was like, are you guys hiring by any chance? And if it's so, is there a discount involved? And it was where I really started to think about books as a business. And I think that that is a really important thing. I'm sure all of you are passionate readers. And part of being a successful writer, I think, is understanding that this thing that we treasure so much, these sort of fetishistic objects, whether you are reading them on your Kindle or whether you're collecting first editions, it's a business. It's a creative endeavor, but it's also a business. And understanding that, I think, is really key and important throughout the process. Anyway, it was when I first understood that you could be passionate about books, you could make a living being passionate about books, not a great living, so don't go rush out and become literary agents. I don't need the competition. But it was when I first started to understand, like, oh, there's a person who helps. You know, at the store, I love to put a book in people's hands and say, oh my God, you've never read Jeanette Winterson, or, you know, you don't know this novel, you're going to love it, and really have that direct experience with a reader. And it was where I first began to understand that there were people who got to do that earlier in the process, where they got to see a book as a manuscript and say, oh my God, this is amazing, and I'm going to help put it in the hands of an editor, put it in the hands of a bookseller.
Joy, let me ask you just, and your agency concentrates on?
Fiction, yes. I would say at this point, 100% fiction. And I'm happy to talk about nonfiction just to give you information, but in terms of querying us, it's a fiction.
So nothing Joy says is true.
Yeah.
It's all fiction. thank you, Julie Bear. I'm going to ask you two more questions.
Yeah, yeah.
Renee Zirkabrat, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you started and your agency?
Sure. I got started working at Putnam as an editorial assistant. Sorry. Like Julie, I grew up as a reader. You know, when my parents wanted to punish me, it wasn't that I couldn't watch television. It was that I wasn't allowed to read late into the evening, which I'm not sure if that's actually a good thing or a bad thing. So I worked all the way, I worked myself up the ladder. That doesn't make sense. I became an editor at Doubleday, so I won't say. And so my experience is, for the most part, editorial. I didn't work in marketing or publicity or sales, but I did have an opportunity to work with those different folks at Doubleday and at Putnam. I also, when I was at Putnam, because they weren't actually paying me a living wage, I would work. I worked at Shakespeare & Company on the weekends on the Upper West Side. And I have to say, it was a really enlightening experience, because sometimes when you're working inside a publishing house, you're kind of in this bubble and you forget that the outside world exists. And so it was a really great experience to interact with book buyers and get a sense of what appeals to them. Is it a title? Is it a jacket? At the time, it was really book reviews, which, as we all know, don't exist in great numbers the way they used to. A lot of newspapers have cut back or just sort of eliminated book review coverage. So it was really a wonderful experience to interact with readers on a one-to-one level and be able to recommend books. Shakespeare & Company was famous for having their staff picks, and you know, as a salesperson, I was able to contribute to the staff picks, which was really wonderful. And then I left publishing for a while. I thought I'd work in the film business because I thought it was glamorous, but actually it's not. And I read screenplays for Dennis Leary, which was, well,
less than glamorous,
let's just say. And then decided to get back into publishing and started working as an agent. And I worked for another agency for a little while, and then I opened up my own company. And it's mostly fiction, but I do represent nonfiction as well, history, science, some cookbooks. My list reflects the kind of list I had when I was at Doubleday. I was a generalist or an editor who did a little bit of everything from Amy Vanderbilt to literary fiction to translations, and that's what my list is today.
Great. And I think, you know, what you're hearing is probably typical, that, you know, agents are not the barriers between you and getting published. They're book lovers who really want to see the folks they represent published. Your task is to find the right one. And so we're going to talk about that. So let me, I'm going to start with a little interview, and then we'll just play 20,000 questions. Okay. So maybe some general advice. How should one go about identifying which agents might be the right agents for them?
Sure. Okay. Well, there are a number of great outlets online where you can research different agents and agencies. So I'm sure you're all familiar with Publishers Marketplace, which lists book sales. There are also places such as Agent Query. There's also the agent database at Poets and Writers, and also the agent database at the AAR Online, which is the Association of Authors Representatives. And there you can start doing research. If you've written historical fiction, you can start to look for agents on any of those sites that do represent historical fiction. Another way to find those agents is to open the acknowledgement pages of some of your favorite books. And so let's say you're a fan of Laurie Moore, and you think your writing maybe would resonate with those readers or fans of Laurie Moore, so you can certainly contact her agent. That's another good way. Coming to conferences like this and meeting with agents is another great way to get a sense of what we represent. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's still sort of all about the writing. I mean, we may say we don't like this or we do like this, but at the end of the day, like, when we're reading something and it resonates or we have a visceral reaction, all those other sort of rules go out the window. So, I mean, we like to be able to give very specific advice, but I really think at the end of the day, in some ways, it's a crapshoot, whether we like something or not.
I think it's also really important to do really thorough research. So if you compile a list of, let's say, 25 agencies from various resources, whether it be the online sites that Renee mentioned or a book like Jeff Herman's Guide to Agents and Publishers, something like that, take a minute to Google all those agencies and see if you can find interviews online that any of those agents have done, or take a look at their websites. It's really, really important because there actually is going to be a lot of information given directly from some of those agents out there. It will save you time, and it will also show that, you know, one thing that I find very frustrating is we have a very clear list on our agency's website of the things that we don't represent. We also have a clear list of how we like to see submissions. And when people don't take the time to simply just go to barrenliterary.com and look at that, it feels like, okay, so are you, like, you know, how seriously are you taking this? And is my time, is, you know, your time worth more than my time? So I think little things like spelling the name of the agent, right? I know this sounds really obvious, but you'd be amazed at how many people send me a letter, dear Mr. Barrenliterary. And I'm like, thanks so much for taking the time.
You're lucky you don't have my name.
Yes.
You know, it's probably also worth saying that as much as you are trying to get an agent, agents are looking for clients.
Listen, we...
It works both ways.
We eat what we kill, people. Okay? We work on commission. And I come into the office every day hoping that there will be a letter that I open that makes me want to put everything aside and start reading and miss my subway stop and rush into the office the next week and say, I can't wait to sell this. This is what we live for. It's why we do the job. So we are looking for you. I know it can feel, certainly on your end, like, especially if you've been trying a lot of agents and you haven't found one, it can take 50 query letters. It can take 100 query letters. It's so personal. And it's especially true for fiction, but it can also be true for nonfiction as well, because maybe you're writing about, you know, a certain subject in nature, And Renee is really interested in it, but it just so happens that last year she represented a book very similar. It's that personal. It's your novel is all about heartbreak, and I just had my heart broken, and the last thing I want to do is read it. It's not true, I'm very happily in love. Thank you for your concern. I was just going to say, it's that personal. Like, it's like, oh my God, I can't read this right now. And so, you know, perseverance, very important, also understanding how personal it is.
And also, I'm going to ask Renee for you to speak about this. Once, let's say you have successfully narrowed it down to a small group of agents who do seem to genuinely represent the kind of writing that you do, that you see my name would fit in this list when you look at their list. There's more to it than that, too. It's also just plain old human interaction. There are different styles of agenting. Some edit heavily, some don't. Some do a lot of hand-holding, some don't. And your personality might need or desire or not want one of those things, too.
Right, so I advise when you send out your query letters to do send them out multiple. Do not just send it out to one agent exclusively unless you have a relationship with that agent. Maybe an agent read an earlier novel, gave you really great feedback, and in the end you decide to scrap that novel, you have something new, and you want to go to that one agent only. But so if you do send it out to, let's say, 12 agents, and you're really, really lucky, five write back that they want to represent you. So what is the next step? Okay, the next step is to notify everyone who you sent it to that you have, you know, interest, and that even the people you have not heard back from, so there are 12, five people said I want to represent you, you email those seven agents and say, just want to let you know, I have interest, I'm going to be talking to agents, I need to hear back from you, and give them, I would say, anywhere from a week to 2-3 weeks. I mean, you know, there are all kinds of deadlines, depending on how eager or anxious the five agents are. And then, you know, once you have all the agents who are even representing you, you have a chance to talk to them or meet with them if you're in New York. And then when you put, before you pick up the phone or before you start your phone call, put together a list of questions of things that are really important to you, because those are the questions you want to ask. And sometimes there's so much excitement, you're so excited, you've heard how hard it is to get an agent, now you have five or eight people or however many who want to represent you, you don't want to forget any of your questions.
I'm just going to interrupt. This, all of this is true even if you only have one person.
Yes.
Like, even if only one person has said yes, you still have the right and should take the opportunity to do everything that Renee is saying.
Yes, all those questions.
I'm going to interrupt too, just to say that we're going to say this again. Similarly, when we talk about literary magazines in the next session, it's part of your job as a professional writer who's trying to move through publishing, through the many, many steps of publishing, to keep track of what you do.
Yes.
So that, as Renee was saying, that when you have queried 12 people and one or two or five or all of them write back, that you inform all of them that something's happening, or that at least you even know that you wrote to them before, should you query them again about something else.
Right. So then you know, you're asking your questions, and some of the questions to ask is, you know, do you think do you think my novel needs a lot of editorial work, and what are your suggestions for revision? This is a really important question, because you want to make sure that you and your agent are on the same editorial page. And when an agent is giving you feedback, it's not just to hear himself talk, although it may seem that way sometimes. This is what they really believe. Like, here's what I really love about your novel, but here are some weak spots. And I think we need to work on making these areas stronger, these characters more developed. And so you really, they're not just saying it, because I've had this, I think almost every agent has gone through an experience. You sign up a client, you think you're on the same editorial page, you send them notes, and then all of a sudden, you know, you get sort of resistance, and you think, no, but this is what we talked about.
If you don't agree
with
the agent's notes, then it's not a match.
It just,
because just saying, sure, no problem, and then not taking any of those edits, or taking edits that you don't really feel are right for the book that you wanted to write, isn't going to make anybody happy. It's not going to work for anybody in the long run.
So that's the first thing, revisions. And then another important thing, I'm going to keep it short, is you need to let the agent know how you like to communicate. Because there are some writers who kind of want to disappear, and they say, you know what, when I'm ready, or if I have a question, I'll be in touch. And then other writers need a lot of hand-holding. And, you know, both work, but you just have to let the agent know. And then you also have to ask the agent, how do you communicate? Is it your assistant? Is it you? Do you do it by phone? Do you do it by email? Because you both have to be happy. I've talked to writers who say, you know, my agent only emails me. Well, some agents don't like the phone.
It's tough if you don't like the phone.
I know. It's really tough, but there are some agents who...
Yeah, if you know that you are going to need to be, you know, have your hand held, then you need to make sure that the person you're talking to is that works that way and has that availability for you. Part of, I think, what Renee is saying is you have to know what your own, sort of know yourself and know what style is going to work for you and make you feel good so that you can suss out. If you really want to talk to that person directly and not their assistant, and you're going through this process and the only person you're talking to is their assistant, that's how it's going to be. It's not going to miraculously change when they sign you. So take note of that.
So, yes.
I think I could keep asking questions, but I think we should go to your questions. So I'm going to ask that if you have a question, you go to either of the mics at the front of the hall so that everyone can hear your question. If everyone's terribly shy, I will keep asking questions.
Can I add one thing to what you were saying? So it's a line I'm going to steal from another agent. We were on a panel together, and I just want to remind everyone that despite the reputation agents have for, you know, keeping writers away from publishers and being naysayers, we are optimists. And if we weren't optimistic, we wouldn't show up at the office. We believe that when we come in, we are going to open that letter, open that email, and find something really great waiting for us. So I just want to remind you, we do feel that way. We genuinely are excited, despite our reputation.
We have a question.
Yes, I have submitted my novel. I sent it out in three ways. I mean, not the entire thing, but query letter, synopsis, and whatever, how many chapters I requested to 50 or 60 agents in the last 7 months, of whom 10 requested a partial or a full read. And all of them then said they weren't interested, two disappeared without following up. Now, you talked about perseverance and it's taking 50 or 100, but at what point? I mean, I think what's happened is I must have a good query letter and then they read the manuscript and there's some letdown maybe, so what advice can you give me?
How do you feel sort of having taken a little space away from working on the book and sending it out about how much revision you've done and what state the book is in? I mean, is it possible that the book could use a little bit more work? Did you work on it for 10 years and, you know, revise 50 times and are you done? Or is it like you took it, you know, you sort of got it to where you could get it and you sent it out and it's possible there's maybe some more work to be done?
Well, I think I've revised it 7 or 8 times.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it's flawed, but I think that it's as good as I can make it.
Mm-hmm. Right. it's hard to say, I mean...
Are you in a writing group? I mean, do you have other writers you share your work with? People who are honest, sometimes brutally honest, even? And what do they... there are a lot of writers, you know, when you read about their first book being published, it's actually not the first book that they've written. They'll have one or two or three locked in a credenza that will never see the light of day. Oh, so you... Okay, so maybe, you know, I haven't read your novel... maybe this isn't quite the book, but with each book you're getting closer. And the other question is, the other question I have is, I didn't hear your entire question. Did you get any feedback from agents, or you said you didn't hear from the 10 who had requested?
Most of them just said, I'm sorry, this is not right for us. Two did not get follow-up, and two did give critiques that were...
Okay, was there feedback useful?
Well, it was useful in that they said very similar things.
Okay. I think the message sort of that I usually have is if you feel there is more work to be done, then do the more work. Or put it aside and try something else. Or if there's more work to be done but you don't feel like you can do it, try and find yourself a community that can help you with it. Think about hiring an outside editor. I think the problem is, even though I would speak for Renee, we do a lot of editing. I usually spend about a year on a manuscript before it goes out on submission. It does have to be very far along before I'm going to take it on. And so if I read something that I like, but it just looks like it needs more than I can really do, it's going to get a pass. Another thing to think about is maybe the first 50 or so pages, because that's about all we're going to read. You know, if we have trouble with the first 50 pages, it's unlikely. I take home, I don't know, 8 different manuscripts a weekend, the first 50 pages of 8 different things. That does not include probably 3 full manuscripts by clients of mine. And I tear through those first 50 pages, and if there's anything that's holding me back, I'm probably not going to keep going. That's how important those first chapters are.
That's right. I want to share a quote, I think, or a concept, from Hannah Tinti, a wonderful author who's also a publisher of One Story magazine you all should know about as fiction writers. On another panel we had done earlier, a question about how do I know when a manuscript is ready to send out? And I thought her advice was really kind of brilliant. You said that you got similar feedback from multiple people. That suggests that you can disagree with all of them, mm-hmm. but that suggests there's consensus about what needs to be done to this manuscript. And that the fact that they gave you feedback suggests that if you can do that, you could resend it, having addressed it. What she said was, if you're in a writing group, and you should be, at the point that everyone disagrees about what should be done with your manuscript, that's when it's ready.
That's great advice.
That is really good advice.
Thank you very much.
Good luck. Next question.
Hi. This is kind of similar. I had an experience where I sent out my first batch of query letters, got some requests for partials, and then no's. And I've done significant revisions to the first 50 pages since then. Is it okay to query those same agents and be like, hi, I've made significant revisions, very politely ask them to read it again?
Sure. I mean, I think I would, if you're going to do that, I think I would throw a bunch of new people in the mix as well. And I think it's good to have a group of people that you think look really good as matches for you, but there's a lot of us out there, and there's a lot of good matches. So don't sort of stay just with that group.
And remind the agents who read the previous draft that this is a resubmit.
Okay, and it's similar. So some of those, they have been paper queries mm-hmm. sent to them, and then either the agent or their assistant emailed me to request the material. Mm-hmm. Should I send the paper letter again if that's their state of preference online, or because I have the email address, do you think it's okay to approach through email?
Personally, I would be fine with the reapproach through email, but on the off chance that somebody else, I'm very casual about that stuff, is not, I might, to be on the safe side, go with the letter.
I agree. Some agents are casual about everything except submissions and queries. They get a little bent out of shape.
Okay, thank you.
Let me ask a sort of follow-up question. If someone does get feedback, if only it did this, I would be interested. Should they rush to get that done, or
no,
should they take their time?
No.
Two things. One is, on the rare occasion I offer feedback, because I really don't do it so much anymore, I think if I really know what to do, I'm either going to take it on and do it, or if it's so much that needs to be done, But sometimes I do say, and actually, I'll tell the story. I got a query letter in the mail/pile from an unpublished writer who's working on a World War I novel. It sort of intrigued me. I asked to see it. It was like 800 pages. The writing was so good, but I couldn't even find the plot. But there was something very haunting about the writing, and I called the author, actually, and I said, I can't represent this. I can't even really give you a lot of concrete feedback at this point. I can tell you that you have, 3 different stories going on, and you need to pick one. She took a year. She did drop me an email halfway through the year to say, just want to thank you for your feedback, let you know I'm working on it, hope I'll have the opportunity to send it to you, But she took a year, which told me that she took that feedback really seriously, and given the amount of work that needed to be done, it was at least a year's worth of work. And then she came back, and while it still had issues and problems, I loved it. We took another year to work on it together, and then happily sold it to Norton. And I feel like when I tell somebody, and this happens with clients too, here's what you need to do, and here are things to think about, and it comes right back to me, and right back is pretty much anything sooner than 3 months, I would say, it tells me that you can't have possibly done the work you needed to do in that amount.
It's probably worth pointing out that if you guys give editorial suggestions, it's not copy editing suggestions.
No. Right.
It's a writing
big
suggestion.
Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, it's comments that are embedded in the manuscript, now that we can use track changes, and also an editorial letter. And it's also, you know, thinking down the road, it's good training, because once you're working with an editor, let me tell you, if you send something back to an editor within a week,
within a month,
well,
unless they've asked for
unless
it,
they've
unless
asked
they're
right.
on the last.
But I mean, because sometimes I, you know, even with clients, as Julie said, you send something back and it comes back a week later, and I think impossible, unless you have superpower over space and time that I'm unaware of, not possible. First of all, you even need time, before you sit down and start writing, you need time to think about what we've suggested. And you need to start looking through the manuscript before you even start typing in or hitting accept changes or whatever, you know, your method of revision is. And so we, you know, we take this very seriously. And when we're editing, it's usually not 9 to 5. It's on the weekends, okay? So if we're putting all this time and effort into it, we would like to think that you, on the other end, are, you know, respecting the time and work we put into it during our off hours. But then you're taking this seriously, because as Julie said in her opening, this is a business. It's an informal business, and you may become friendly with your agent. I have clients who stay over at my apartment, but at the end of the day, it's still a business, and there are certain rules, you know, you need to respect and observe. And taking your time with revisions is one of them. And so, as Julie was talking about the World War I novel, you know, the fact that this person spent a year made her really excited to read it by the time. It wasn't, I think sometimes writers think that if they take a year or 9 months
the
or 18 months,
her interest
we'll
is
win. It'll be like, oh, we already forgot about you. Quite the opposite. Our interest becomes fleeting when 2 weeks later it comes back.
I have a client that I read a first chapter of her book for a first chapter contest, and I loved it. My emails were and I said, you know, I read this chapter and I really loved it, and I'd love to see the book, and she wrote back and she said, that's all I have, is the first chapter. And so I wrote to her every year around the same time for 4 years. And every year she'd be like, still not ready. And at the end of 4 years, she finally had a full manuscript. And we sold it, became a huge bestseller. And I would have waited another 4 years, happily. I keep a little file. But I do want to say one other thing, which is that because we so rarely offer feedback, if you do get feedback from us and we say, you know, come back to me, we really mean it. And I wouldn't ignore that. I would take that opportunity. If somebody says, you know, I really, really loved your writing, it came very close, but I didn't love this, and you put that novel aside and you write another novel, come back to that person. I mean, I am sometimes surprised by how much interest I've expressed in a person's work, and it's come very close, and I've said no, and then they've never kind of returned to me, and I see, you know, a friend or competitor sell their book, and I'm like, wait, hey, what? And I realize that maybe I should have been more, you know, it's a fine line, but don't be intimidated to reach out in a very professional way.
Because it's not an invitation that we extend lightly, because we have so much work, you know, from clients, and then there's submissions and contracts and a lot of things, so we're not going to invite you to resubmit unless we think there's something there, because we don't really have time for that.
Right. Let me ask a trivia, then I'll take a question. I'm not sure, I haven't looked recently at your websites. Do you state approximate length of time it would take you to respond to a query?
No.
I think most people don't.
Yeah.
What might be, or tell us for you guys what it generally is. In other words, at what point do you give it up and forget about it?
As
a writer, not
my website is, the woman who designed my website had a bunch of like personal calamities, and so it's still under construction.
Yeah, I believe she's the same woman in charge of most of the.
Well, Julie has a great website. Yeah. So my website, I made the mistake because I was really optimistic, and I have a really great assistant who's great at sort of reading through a number of queries and then passing on the ones that she thinks I might like, and then the ones that, you know, for diet books or romance, she'll just, you know, send them away. And
Or just read.
But no, I'm not going to do romance or diet books, but. So I originally said 6 weeks. I have to take that down because that's not good. And so I would say it is anywhere literally from a day.
Yeah, I mean, if you're, it's like sometimes you're just like, you know what,
I can't,
I don't want to do anything else. I'm just going to sit here with a bunch of queries and blow through, you know, 150.
Or if you're on hold with Verizon for 3 hours.
Time Warner Cable. Where are you?
Yeah, writer's best friends.
Yeah. But you know, we probably get somewhere around 75 to 100 queries a week. So it can take me 8 weeks. I'm actually quicker at getting back to the query itself than I am to the manuscript, just going back to the person who said she, you know, had, I mean, sometimes I request a partial or a manuscript and it takes me 2 to 3 months to get back to it. Obviously, if you email me and you say, I have an offer of representation, it's going straight to the top of the pile, but it's easier to say no. And then, you know, it takes less time to say no than it does to consider.
Well, let me ask, and similarly, do the two of you specify query letter only or query letter with some number of pages, or do you leave that?
Mine is query, no one follows it, but mine is, you know, my, here's what I ask for. I ask for a brief synopsis. I ask for your publishing credentials if you have them. It's okay if you don't. A brief bio. And then I ask why you're writing to me specifically. By the way, I do get a lot of queries for you because I get a lot of people referencing some of your clients.
That's strange. Our names are not
I know. And I occasionally get Dear Julie Bear.
We both have bangs. We both live in the West Village.
But so my, and then I get a lot of people who say, you know, I've been to your website, you know, so here it is, and I've attached the first 75 pages in the body of the email. Now, my eyes are not that great anymore, so I need reading glasses, and I don't like reading lengthy emails, which is why I ask for the first chapter as an attachment. Now, occasionally people will...
See, I'm the opposite.
You're the opposite.
I don't like an attachment.
I like attachments.
I don't like attachments from weird people, I don't know. Not that you're weird.
No, I have a Mac. Are you on a Mac or a PC?
PC.
Ah, okay. Macs don't have viruses. PCs do. Where's Apple?
And now we're going to be a commercial.
Now, exactly. So I actually don't mind attachments. I find it easy to read on my iPad. I have, and sometimes when I get these emails, they're formatted weirdly. So it's like a really, you know, wide margins, and it's all the way down, and I just sort of look at it, and my eyes glaze over. And the thing is, what my website says is if you don't follow the submission guidelines, you probably won't get a response. And I can't read it, and I don't want to have to copy, cut, and paste and put it into a Word document.
Yeah, I mean, the lesson here is don't start off on the wrong foot. If someone has provided you with clear and simple instructions,
that's why I say do your research.
Follow
just
them.
Look at the website.
Because don't start off with them already mad at you before they've even read anything because you sent this giant attachment. I want to share one other thing from the query letter session that was in here this morning. I'm not sure if it came up in the other session. First of all, you should never be blanket bombing, you know,
your agent.
Never ever do that. But even if you are taking your query letter that you've crafted and you're sending it to even your 6 or 12 agents that you have carefully selected, do each one by one. Don't do a mail merge. Because what often happens, and it's very, very transparent, it's not
the
always
color.
Obvious on your end. When you cut and paste things and put them in an email, and then someone else gets it, the pasted part will be in a different font.
Or color
than everything else. So
and
it's like, dear,
totally
there.
Just
you know,
like a little
very, very
bit
accurate.
Of personalization. I mean, I think Renee makes a really good point, which is it is very flattering, because we like to be flattered, because who doesn't? If you say, you know, I am writing to you particularly because I loved, you know, it doesn't even have to be that it's a book that you feel yours is like. It can just be like, I read this book and I loved it, and I saw you were the agent, and it made me want to reach out to you.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be detailed, or it could be, you know, you were on a panel, and I like what you had to say about X, Y, and Z. I read this interview. I have a very unusual last name, and some guy had a name very similar to mine. It was totally upfront. He's like, I'm querying you because our names are so similar, and it might be kismet. You know, and it was sort of weird, but you know what? His query was well written.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked for the first 3 chapters. It wasn't for me. But, you know, I thought, okay, here's
but
the
anyway,
sense of humor. Yeah, you know, it didn't take long, and I was like, okay, it's not for me. And I sent him to, you know, Agent Query and the AR online.
See, this is so fascinating. This is like an example on how different we are. Like, I feel like whenever anybody writes anything personal, like, I saw your picture, and I really like your glasses.
No, that would creep
me
out.
Do you have my home address too? Like,
no, I had someone show up at my apartment. That was a weird thing. That creeps me out. The glasses.
But the name is okay.
The name, because, you know, I didn't choose the name.
So
I mean, I'm sort of stuck with it.
We should get to the person.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh,
I'm sorry. You've been so patient.
Let's
go to the question.
Thanks. Oh, it's really closely related. But I was just going to ask how you, if you're going through the slush pile, what is it about query letter that makes you stop and take note? I've noticed that a lot of my writing friends have done a really good job of networking, and they sort of have ins and a lot of agencies that say we don't take any queries. So if you're working from the slush pile, then
I mean, I have to say, so I had an amazing boss at my first agency, Sanford Greenberger Associates. Her name is Tressa Park. And she, when she was like 32, she picked a letter out of the slush pile by a former pharmaceutical sales rep named Nicholas Sparks. Okay. She taught me that the slush pile is your best friend. And I have found that to be true. I would say 90% of my most successful clients actually came out of the slush pile, some of whom had no formal writing training whatsoever. Wonderful book, The Song of Achilles, Madeline Miller, came in the slush pile, won the Orange Prize last year, never took an MFA class, didn't know any published writers, had no ins. I mean, I think I certainly take those queries just as seriously. And what I'm looking for is just something very clear, very professional, and that you do a really good job in the middle, in that body paragraph, in the middle of the letter paragraph, about making the story sound interesting. So I'm sure you heard this morning, but think of it like the flap copy on a book jacket, which is just enough information to make you want to buy the book, but not so much that you feel like now you know everything that's going to happen. And I just look for those things that jump out. I look for, you know, it's a story, you know, in her case, it was Greek mythology. And I was like, oh, I love Greek mythology. You know, and then it was, you know, I fictionalized the story. It's a love story. I tend to just glom on usually to one fact. It's a, you know, another great slush pile find was a book called The Heretic's Daughter, which was a novel about the Salem witch trials, which I had always been fascinated in. So I usually find it's like being able to sort of say, this is what my book is about in very clear two sentences, kind of.
And also, it's a sense for us to get a sense of your writerly voice a little bit. So, you know, you've spent a lot of time working on your novel, years. Don't dash off a query letter. So as Julie was saying earlier, like, make sure the person's name is spelled correctly, that you're sending it actually to the right person. Don't do the cutting and pasting. Make sure there aren't grammatical errors. You know, I sometimes will start reading something and there's a modifier in the first sentence, and I think, oh.
I have terrible grammar, so that doesn't
matter. Okay. My grammar is so-so. I mean, you know. But, you know, so just really spend the time. And when you think you're done, put it aside for 24 hours. Don't look at it. And just read it one more time. And if you're in a writing...
Is that a book I want to read?
Right. Is that a book I want to read is a very good question. Also, if you're in a writing group, share it with the people in your writing group and say, you know, would you want to read this book?
And sometimes people make the mistake of doing a lot of comparisons. You know, this is for fans of XYZ, or people who loved this book are going to love that book. That can be very helpful if it's a very particular kind of story, if it's historical fiction in the tradition of some other historical novelist, or if you're a very sort of wacky, offbeat George Saunders kind of writer. But picking big famous writers like this is, you know, I don't know who, but you know, that sort of that kind of generalization, just like saying it's about the themes of loss and love.
Avoid cliches.
Tells me like nothing about your book.
And anyone who ever bought The Help under Harry Potter.
Right, I mean.
And the other thing is, I sometimes find that people say, it's a book about this, as if, and it's about this, and it's like a kitchen sink, because, and it will appeal to everyone, okay? No, it won't. It will appeal to no one. If you cast two, this is something I learned working as an editor when I would go into these jacket meetings.
I was just going to say, this is totally a cover thing,
right?
Yeah, you're trying
to get everyone
male
to
readers,
love a book.
And female
and
readers.
And female
older
readers.
And younger readers.
And fish and cats. And you know who you get?
None
no
of the
one.
Above.
So what you really want to do is think like a publisher, which is identify your primary audience. And then what a publisher does is build from that primary audience instead of, you know, casting this huge, huge net. So really, it doesn't have to be about 17 different things.
Thanks.
Next question.
Come on, don't be shy.
No more questions?
Oh, no more questions?
You all know exactly what to do. Okay, here's a question.
I was wondering, once you sign on with an agent, how fast or slow do things generally move? You know, what's the
It really depends on what stage your book is at. I mean, I have, on the rare occasion, taken a client on and done a very quick maybe one or two line edited revisions that we turn around in, let's say, like 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
That's very fast for me. And then send the book out. More often than not, I usually say take on average 6 to 8 months
mm-hmm.
to do 2 to 3 line edited drafts, or one if it's, you know, close, but that much time. But as soon as the book itself is as good as we can make it, and I do torture my clients, and I feel that every one of them is always like, oh my God, let's just send it out already, like, by the time we're done. When that process happens, then again, it can be sort of very fast or very slow. I've sold books in 48 hours, and I've sold books 6 months later. And I've sold books after sending it out to an entire round of 28 publishers and having everybody turn it down and us going back to revise and then sending it out to another 10 publishers a year and a half later. So it's very fluid. I mean, it really, a lot of it depends on what how the editors respond to it, because if editors respond quickly, then you can get everybody else quickly
mm-hmm.
to give you an answer. And if I suddenly have an offer in a week, I can make everybody else, just like when you have offers of representation. But sometimes it can really drag out, and what I think often surprises writers is once you sign the book, once you sign the deal, let's say that, you know, didn't take too long, then it usually takes your editor a little while to get their edits to you. So let's say that takes 3 months, and then they expect you to take at least 3 or 4 months with those edits, if not longer. When you have a final, complete, and accepted manuscript, meaning your editor has made you go back at least once, if not twice or more, and the book is going into the copy editing process, it's often another 10 to 14 months before your book is going to be published. And that's the thing that really freaks people out. They're like, I have a revision, I did a book deal, I thought my book's going to be out like next month. I already told everybody to go back. It can be a very extended process, but it's an important one, and we do that for a lot of reasons. Which is why you shouldn't quit your day job.
Well, there are lots of reasons you shouldn't quit your day job. What Julie said. I think you covered it. I'm not sure.
I want to ask
a
follow-up. Let's say that you believe the manuscript is done, excellent. You've sent it out to 28 editors. No one bid. What happens next?
You jump from the highest window. No. Part of what Julie said was, first of all, you look at all the responses you've received, okay? Oh, you can't hear. I'm sorry. So you look at all the feedback that's come in. You ask your client to as well. I mean, I don't know about Julie. I tend to send rejections to my clients, unless someone has written something really mean, which has only happened once. It was sort of odd because I had received a preempt around the same time that I got a finger wagging from an editor about something. And then, you know, you talk to your client and say, okay, well, there seems to be a consensus that this character is really unbelievable or unlikable, or the sequence
unlikable
of events.
Unlikable and unsympathetic is, I have to say, comes up
yeah.
more than anything else.
Yeah.
In terms of what makes people turn away.
And then you have to figure out, you know, is there a way to make the character more likable, more sympathetic, and maintain the integrity of your novel? Or is it maybe just that this character has to be? I mean, you have to have an honest conversation with yourself after getting the feedback, with your agent, and then figure out, you know, the next step.
I will interrupt and say, I had a novel that I sent out this summer, and it was the second novel. And it was a great book. I mean, it was wonderfully written, really fun, lovely story. And everybody liked it, and nobody loved it. And the consistent feedback was, in this incredibly competitive market, with an author whose track record wasn't stellar, meaning the first book wasn't a bestseller, the book was good, but it wasn't special. And it had to be special. And the author and I went back and forth a lot, and at the end of the day agreed that it was a good book, but it wasn't like a great book. And it was a really good book, but it wasn't likely to become that kind of special thing.
Buzzed about.
Yeah, and that people were gonna have a hard time getting attention for it, the sales force was gonna have a hard time getting jobs about it. And to his incredible credit, and I think it is the most mature thing that a writer can do, and I have a lot of clients who've done it and none who have ever regretted it, he put the book aside and he started something else.
Yeah, the sort of what used to be known as the mid-list book, which is what Julie just described, something that is really good, but maybe sort of isn't new in terms of storytelling or narrative or anything, you know, isn't going to be buzzed about, that those books have sort of gone away. They're really hard to sell to publishers. They're hard for publishers to publish. I mean, unless it's sort of genre and it's part of a series or something, but if we're talking about literary fiction, it has to be really dynamic. It has to feel really fresh and new, or it has to be a really big story.
Coming of age, very tough.
Really?
Everybody has read 1,000 coming of age novels, and they are incredibly hard to get attention for. And the biggest book buying audience is over a certain age, and they aren't so interested in reading coming of age stories anymore.
Do we have another question? I'm going to ask you to come up to one of the two mics so we can all hear your question.
I was just curious if you do like something a lot and you get it out to some editors and you're getting this consensus that the character isn't sympathetic or is unlikable, as you said, these are then right. How do you feel having found either not had a problem with that yourself, or thinking that the character was perfectly sympathetic?
In my experience, when it's happened, it's not that I didn't know or the author didn't know that there were challenges to. I mean, I think if you don't know and you hear that from everybody, there's a problem. That you're really not reading your work honestly. And that does happen. I mean, I think, this is gonna be so sexist, but I think it happens a lot more with male characters. Because, you know, the thing to keep in mind is that 90% of the editors that we're submitting fiction to are women, and probably that number is who's buying fiction. I mean, one of the biggest problems that we face right now is that fiction is being bought by women, not by men. Want to change that? Go out and buy some books, men. But what we did, I had a really interesting situation like this, where I had a book that I loved. It was written by a woman, but it was a male narrator, the thing that was incredibly frustrating was it was a very sort of Philip Roth, and in fact, there were some comparisons when it was finally published. To him, and I think if it had been a man, people would have maybe felt differently. It was a very Philip Roth kind of character, so, you know. So we looked at, you know, everybody, Tuan's sympathetic, and it's by a woman, and it's very dark, and he does some very bad things. And what we did is we went through the book and we thought, okay, we're not going to change who he is, but we have to modify some of the very bad things. So, you know, his wife has breast cancer and he cheats on her. He's not going to cheat on her, but he's going to fantasize about cheating on her. You know, things are where we felt like we kept the integrity. We softened him in places that we felt like we could, where we didn't, you know, change him. And I have to say, and then, you know, we did it. We sort of looked at the whole novel and we sort of said, if he's unsympathetic, do we understand why he is the way he is? Is there enough background to how he became such a jerk, or, you know, like, he's raised in this, I mean, he was, you know, and the story was, which I think helped people identify with him, was he was sort of a generation of first-generation Jewish kid, boy, son, you know, to parents who doted on him and gave him everything and made him a prince. He's basically
entitled.
My father. Entitled, very entitled. My father's like, she nailed that guy. And so he sort of went through this life thinking, like, you know, he was, and so we gave a lot of backstory, and I think that helped understand how he, and in the end we found an editor who was like, and I have to say it's very satisfying when the book came out, it was a big success, and then I sent a copy to everybody who turned it down, and I was like, you know, to share this wonderful reviews that we've been getting for this novel, having a book pretty soon.
It can also, you know, books are for the most part acquired by committee. Mm-hmm. So it might, having been an editor, you know, I would read something and occasionally, you know, my colleagues would not see the brilliance. They would fail to see it. George Saunders, I mean, I could give you a list of things that I was not allowed to really buy. But, and then, you know, so when you're an editor and you're going to reject something, you know, you can't keep going back to if you've had to reject a few things by the agent and saying, you know, I loved it, but I got no in-house support. Because that means you can't acquire, right? You don't have the power or the authority. But on the other hand, you can't keep saying, well, you know, here's why it doesn't work. So it's a little more complicated. I mean, I don't know what happened, whether there were some editors who loved it, and then in committee,
a couple, yeah,
marketing and sales.
I think that it is, it is a problem that fiction by committee is incredibly challenging, and I personally, I like books that have unsympathetic characters because I think there
That's
are a lot
life.
Of unsympathetic people,
That's
right? And it's life, and it makes them interesting, but they can be a hard sell, and if you think about it like a business, you can understand why people want to spend time with a character that they connect with emotionally, and to pay $25 and spend, you know, however long it takes to read a book for a character you hate, it's a challenge.
I want to put a plug in too for smaller publishers, because
yes. It went to Algonquin, I have
perfect.
To say.
Perfect, so these were, let's say, challenging books, which can be some of our best works of literature are the more challenging books, right? A large house has an economic necessity to publish a book that's going to sell X number of copies. And it does have to be sold to a committee. I think the basic theory, which makes sense in a house that has to make a certain amount of money, if those five editors, whoever it is, if they haven't all bought it, how can they expect the whole world to buy it, right?
Right.
In a small house, it's usually one editor, who may also be the publisher. They like it, they're going to publish
it. Or even if it's a group, they sort of trust the taste.
Right.
Of
and they might be willing
that.
To take on something that they'll do in a smaller print run. They feel like they can identify smaller fans, but many times much better to sell out 4,000 copies than to not sell 25,000 copies.
Right.
Yeah, and we ended up selling over 50,000. I mean, it was really.
Yeah.
I love Algonquin. I have to say, Algonquin Books. They're based in Chapel Hill. They're run by Workman. They're amazing. I wouldn't say they're super small now. They're now larger.
I mean,
they only have four editors, three editors.
Yeah. But still, you're dealing with a smaller group, and so they can take a different kind of a risk because their brand is already more focused in a more curious way.
Also, I find in the smaller houses, editorial has more of a say. So when I was at Doubleday, the editors would come in with our books, and here's what we're going to discuss at editorial meeting, and you'd have someone from sales, someone from publicity, someone from marketing. So a lot of the big houses, a lot of the decisions are, or a lot of the acquisitions are killed, not by editorial, but by sales and marketing and publicity, because the publicist is like, how am I going to get any publicity for this book?
And sometimes it is those other decisions. It's entirely a marketing decision.
Right.
It might be, this is actually an amazing book. However, we just had two other books that are about X, Y, and Z, and so we're not going to put another one out right now.
But I think to sort of answer your question more generally, I think it is important to listen to the feedback. And then you can decide for yourself. If you don't agree with it, you don't have to change it, but you have to accept that that's the roadblock we're hitting. And for better or for worse, that's what the market is telling us.
I want to take us back to that point, which is that you have both done the best possible job you can to sell this book, and there are no bites. Okay, there are a couple scenarios. I just want to talk about them because, it's not just getting an agent. Let's say you have an agent, and more people get to this point than probably than the book is sold, right?
Yes, more people find an agent than sell a book.
Right.
Yes.
So at the point
true.
That the book
isn't
sold.
I think there's a sort of disconnect,
right.
You think you're getting an agent, you're going to sell a book.
So let's say there's some feedback about what might happen to the book to maybe make it, to change it, to make it sell.
Did that answer your question, Rosalie?
Yes.
Okay.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
So if that's the case, then it seems like there are a couple of choices.
Yeah.
One is that major revision can happen, and
yes.
You can then resubmit it to folks, right? And the author has to feel like, I want to do that, or no, that's not my book.
And you have to really feel like to revise just to revise.
Right.
Gets very messy, and I have gone down that road too many times.
Well, you
and
have
so
to.
The point is, you very frequently get to a point where it's like, this book
is just not going to
It's not getting there. So
it
then
at all.
The other choice is, move on, write another book.
Or
self-publish it, if you think you can find the audience or it's smaller.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, a writer will say, well, you're clearly the wrong agent for it,
But that's the thing I
want
to get to. At what point should you say, I still really believe in my book, and you did before, but you couldn't sell it. Is it okay to say, maybe I should try another agent?
You certainly can, and if you query agents, I think you need to let them know that my book has been seen by 37 editors who pass. No, you do.
No, you absolutely do.
You do, because...
And I think you need to have a really... I think as long as you're willing to have the conversation with your agent.
Right.
Like I think you need to give them the opportunity, if they really don't want to lose you as a client, to keep you and to convince you that 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 maybe this book needs to be put aside. And, you know, I mean, I think I'd hate for a client just to walk away without having that conversation.
Yeah, I think that's important.
Yeah, I think you owe it to your agent who has put in so much time and effort on revisions, on sending it
out. And by the way, it made no money.
And I have clients who we haven't sold the first book or the first two books, and then they've gone on to have wonderful careers, and I feel sad that we would not have had that opportunity together.
Yeah, let me ask if there's another question. Come on down.
Come on down.
Bob Barker has left the auditorium.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What if you are writing in more than one genre and you have two completed works and you're going to start querying? How do you approach that?
Well, why would you wait until two are done? Didn't you start querying when the first one was done, or what?
Well, I'm almost done with one, and I have another one which I'm working on first, and then.
Well, so you only have one finished book. Yeah,
I think
writers sometimes think, like, I occasionally, although it's been a while, someone says, I have six books.
Oh my God.
Whoa, no.
Unless they're part of a series.
Right. Unless, you know, so genre, you're writing, you know, fantasy, science fiction, thriller, romance or something. So I would, you know, you have one finished book, that's what you start querying. Agents and
do you look for an agent who does both?
Yes. So I think when you talk to people, you want to say, "I'm so glad you're excited about my, my grown-up novel, my adult novel, but I also write young adult. Is that something that you handle? Or I also want to write nonfiction. Is that something you're interested in?" It's one of the questions that when you're interviewing agents, you want to ask them about your long-term career plans. You know, here are some other ideas I have. Do these sound viable? You know, what if I want to do a short story collection next? What if, you know, I want to write poetry?
Okay. Thank you.
Another question? So it's probably safe to say you would not have multiple agents. You have one agent that does multiple things.
For the most part, I mean, I don't do children's illustrated books unless, like, a client. I mean, but if someone were to approach me and say, you know, I do mostly children's illustrated books, but I do have this one novel, I would, you know, and I love
so
the
possible.
Novel. It is sort of possible.
Okay. Good question.
Thanks. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the publishing landscape, and specifically if, as a writer, you should do your homework to find an agent who perhaps publishes authors that's similar to you. Should you be looking for agents who tend to publish with certain types of publishing houses, or is that not really relevant? Is it?
I definitely think it's relevant. I mean, you want to look at the books on the agency's shelves and see your book in their company. Mm-hmm. And if you're writing the kind of book that doesn't look like any of their titles, or you aspire to be published by somebody that they've never done business with, then it's probably not a good fit. I mean, we all sometimes take a flyer and do something different than what we've done before, but I definitely think it's important when you're talking to a prospective agent to say, I'd love to hear who you're thinking of submitting this to, and if you've done work with them before. Have you had authors? Have you had a book like this, or have you, you know, had experience with this kind of book? And that's very important, because the biggest thing about our job is relationships, and it's about being able to call an editor and say, you know, I've known you for 10 years. We've had lunch, you know, 20 times. I know you've been looking for this kind of book. You're going to love it, and I know you're going to do a good job publishing it. I mean, we have to know all the intricacies of everybody's imprint and company, and what does it mean that Random House and Penguin are merging, and what does it mean that Simon Schuster just got rid of Free Press, and I think that's very important. You want to have a sense. That doesn't mean that you can't have a young agent. I mean, I remember when I was like a baby agent, and I was very hard to sign clients, and it was very frustrating, because I worked at a big agency, and I had a lot of amazing mentors and people who helped me with my submission lists, and there are a lot of great young agents out there who can do the job. It's just about making sure that you feel like they're at a company that is going to be taken seriously, that the other things that on their list look legitimate, that they're, you know, somebody who's going to be able to get the job done.
So that's why we go out to lunch. It's not just for a free meal, but it's
speak
to find
yourself.
Out, okay. It's to find out, okay, I know you've published X, Y, and Z. Is that what you're still publishing? Are you looking to do something different? And you'd be surprised, the number of editors who say, you know, I have this hole in my list, okay?
Last year I wasn't looking for that, but now I am.
Or my mandate has changed. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's helpful. So I actually have a list, And I have an idea in my head all the time of what certain editors are looking for, but then every once in a while someone will surprise me.
And they'll say, you know, I know you know me for publishing XYZ, but did you know that I bid on so-and-so and I didn't get it? Or, you know, I mean, it's so personal. Like, you can know that somebody, you know, is a twin, and so you have a book with twins, and you think, oh, remember so-and-so as an or you know they're a twin but they don't get along with their twin. Like, I'm not sending it to that lady.
So yeah, so that's what you know.
By the way, speaking of publishers launch, there's a newsletter that is free that you all probably should sign up for called Publishers Launch. You can just Google it. There's a pay part of it, which is expensive and you actually most of you don't need to have. But the free part is just useful. It's very insider industry, but it gives you an idea of, you know, major sales of authors and who's moving where and whether companies are merging or not. And
I will say this. Don't over-educate yourself.
Yeah.
You don't want to have a conversation with an agent where you're like, I heard that Mary Sue Lucci just became editor and she goes on and she's struggling. What do you think that means? Because that's like, okay, calm down. That's our job. But I do think it's important to understand the landscape. And I would say one of the most important pieces of that is being able to talk about your book in the context of other contemporary books. Don't talk to me about how much you love Joyce and Henry James and, you know, or even Kurt Vonnegut. Like, name three authors that have been published in the last 2 years that don't have to be bestsellers, but are out there getting review attention. And the best way to be able to do that is to go buy books. And it sounds really obvious.
At independence.
I should be speaking, preaching to the choir. But if you are not part of the community that is supporting independent bookstores and the contemporary fiction and nonfiction market, then you have no business trying to be published. Because somewhere down the line, you hope to have a stranger walk into an independent bookstore and pull your book off a shelf. And when we talk about how tough the business is and how hard it is, you know, I often hear people say, why doesn't anybody want to publish short stories? I'll tell you why, because nobody buys them. So go change that. If you suddenly showed publishers by coming out in support of debut short story collections in huge numbers, they would be happy to publish them. It's just that they sell no copies.
Editors love short, literary fiction editors love short stories.
But there's just no sales.
There's no sales. When I worked at Shakespeare and Company, I was always pushing short story collections, and I would have people say, I don't really get them. They're too hard. They're elliptical.
But the amazing thing is,
not.
It's one of those things that you can actually change.
Yes.
You can't do anything about the fact that there are no places to review fiction in this country anymore. But you can do something about how many people buy contemporary writers in print or in ebook from an independent
book. By the way, if you're a short fiction writer, why don't you start a blog? Here's an idea, Dan Vreeland style. Why don't you start a blog where you review
other
short fiction collections?
You will make, oh my god, do you know how many friends you will make who are established, like,
publicists,
editors,
agents?
Writers are so desperate for your love and attention that if you started a blog and you started reviewing, you know, new debut collections, you would be amazed at how many published writers would
And trust
you,
me, if you did that for 2 years,
you would have a whole bunch of people who would
yeah.
be ready to blow their
But every time you were ready to send your own collection out, people would want to read it.
Yeah.
Can't say they'll publish it, but they would want
and
to
And that's just the reason we're emphasizing is because I know there are a lot of ways where you feel like you don't have a say in this whole scenario and control, and this is a way that you really do. I mean, it's like voting. It's just, if you do your part, you are contributing to the health of the industry that you want to be a part of.
To add to that, I think you covered it, but I think if you sort of understand this publishing landscape and understand what your publisher, if you sell your book, or your agent is trying to sort of put into the marketplace, sort of how it fits. I mean, every once in a while there's something groundbreaking, you know, you say, oh, this won't work, and then a book is published, and then boom, okay, well, wow, look, that worked. But for the most part, you know, I mean, there are trends. Okay, vampires, I think, are on the way out, would you say?
Yes.
To be replaced
despite their werewolves.
To be
said, don't try and write a werewolf novel because those won't sell because they've already sold.
Right. So there. So it's not to say that there aren't trends, but by the time you realize it's a trend,
it's over.
It's on its way, sort of out the door. So you have to really, it's a tricky balancing act, and that, you know, you want to publish into a marketplace that's going to be receptive to your work, but on the other hand, it can't be too trendy. I mean, I am now getting a lot of 50 Shades of Grey. Apparently, there's a lot of money to be made in sex writing. Although, but I read that and it's a pale imitation of something that was pretty pale to begin with, I think.
It was great.
Oh, it was great. I missed that. So, thank you, Jeffrey. So, you know, I look at that and I think, oh, Johnny Come Latelys. I mean, I'm not interested. It's like, that is, you know, sort of in a year or two from now, we'll have moved on to spinster fiction.
Expect you to be able to anticipate what's coming out. But it doesn't hurt if you're sitting down to write a novel to sort of do a little research and make sure somebody else hasn't already published an incredibly successful novel about that subject. I mean, you have seen it. There have been, you know, the book that came out 6 months after.
The Confederate Widow.
Right.
You know, the same story, or this, especially if it's based on somebody who's a real life character or a real moment in history or a real moment in time. There's really only room for one of those books.
You know, I want to switch to a whole other agent topic that no one's asked about, so I will. Unless there's a pressing question, run on down. And while you're doing that, I will ask this question. One of the jobs of the agent is in creating a contract for you.
Yes. As an author.
No one said the word contract. It hasn't been uttered.
Well, there's actually two contracts. Not every agent does this, but most agents have an agency agreement, which you and the agent sign at the time of beginning a relationship together. Think of this as a prenuptial agreement. it's like a worst case scenario, but it does, I think, is helpful in that it lays out what everybody sort of is coming into the relationship with and is leaving the relationship with, and it keeps things, it's not like I hope we break up, but if we're gonna break up, let's make sure it's not messy and we spend 3 years in, you know, divorce court. So it outlines, you know, what commission I'm entitled to, what happens if we part ways, what commission I'm still entitled to, because if I sold your book and you leave, I'm still the agent of record for that book. And even if you go on to do your next 20 books with another agent, as long as that book is in print, I will always get my commission on that book. And commission is pretty much straightforward at 15%. If it's a translation sale, we take 20%. It's a film sale, it can sometimes be 20, sometimes 15.
Depending on the agent.
But the agency agreement will outline our relationship, and I think it's helpful. I mean, don't be scared of
it.
Can
I ask even more basic? Does an agent ever charge you to take you
on? An agent should never, ever charge you. It is against the Association of Authors Representatives guidelines. We do not get paid for reading your work. We only get paid when we sell your work. We don't win unless you win.
We don't get paid until you get paid. But the other thing I wanted to add is the other thing that's really important about the agency agreement, it spells out my responsibility to you, meaning if I get an offer, what it spells out in my agreement, and I'm sure Julie's agreement, is that I cannot accept it. Like the, you know,
I don't have an agreement.
Oh, you don't? So you just blindly sign?
You authorize me to do anything.
So, I mean, each one is sort of different, but, you know, it says what my responsibilities are to you and what your responsibilities are to me. One of them is, you know, you have to agree to the fact that you're not under contract with another agent.
One of them says if we sell the book and you get paid for signing the contract and then you fail to deliver your book, I retain the 15% commission on the copy when we sold your book because I did my job.
I did my job, right. It's, you know. So anyway, it's really helpful to have. So aside from the fiduciary responsibilities or relationship, it also spells out, you know, what my obligations are to you and what your obligations are to me.
The second contract is the contract that we negotiate with your publisher. And most agencies have what's called a boilerplate contract, which is a contract that they have established over time with that particular publisher. So I have 4 clients with Little Brown that I've sold to them several books over the course of 8 years. So I've done, you know, enough contracts with them that at this point I fine-tuned all the language. I've really gotten it to be as good as I can get it to be and I want it to be. And of course, at the time of the deal, I'm always trying to get a couple of little extra goodies in
there.
They're
always chipping away.
Always chipping away, and they're always chipping away at it too, which is really frustrating.
They're always changing their boilerplate.
But we are, you know, we are well versed in what all this crazy language means. I mean, when you see it, it's like, what are all these things? But you should ask questions, and you should educate yourself, and you should read your contract. I mean, you know, sometimes clients are just like, okay, whatever, I'm signing. And I'm like, no, let's make sure you understand. You will be delivering this book at this point, and this is what happens if you lie. And
you need to understand sometimes, one of the key things they don't seem to understand is the difference between non-delivery and unacceptability.
Right, so you deliver the manuscript to your editor, you feel like you've done your job, but technically your editor has to read the book and say, yes, we want to publish it. That's accepting it. You can deliver it, and they can say, sorry, no, this doesn't really work for me. We're not accepting it.
Or if you don't deliver at all, that's when you have
to
actually return all the money. Whereas if it's unacceptability, they let you keep a portion of it.
For a certain amount of time,
and then there you try to resell it.
I mean, contracts are very favorable to publishers, and you might very well ask, like, well, what happens if my editor gets fired? What happens if they disappoint me? And unfortunately, contractually, there's very little recourse. But it's good to know what all the clauses mean and what everybody's responsibility. I mean, it's a business, going back to where we started, it's a business relationship, and you wouldn't buy a house or a car, or work with an accountant or a doctor without doing your homework and asking questions. And we just ask that you do the same, because you need to take responsibility.
And the other thing I want to say is, I know that a lot of times writers always say, I don't want to bother my agent. We really don't mind being bothered. We actually prefer...
We'd hate it if you didn't bother.
If you did bother, and then there was somewhere down the road, like a huge problem, and, you know...
I didn't want to bother you, but it turns out tomorrow we have a book due, and I'm not going to be
in it. Yeah, but we actually, you know, we really don't mind. I was just talking to a writer, and he's telling me this whole story. I said, well, what did your agent say? And he said, well, I don't want to bother him. And
yeah.
I was like, oh my God, first of all, you're like the nicest guy on the planet. I can't imagine you ever bothering anyone. I said, but, you know, I've just given you my advice, but it's not really my book. I was staying at a friend's in Massachusetts, and he came over, so sort of a weird confluence of events that I ended up sort of giving him all this advice. But I said, your agent will be only too glad to help you. That's what I think agents have, in part, a maternal instinct. Like, we want to help. We want to see that things go smoothly. It's not that, you know, we're having you sign a contract, collecting our commission, you know, sitting back with a cigar and saying, all right, let me know when it's published. I'll be here. We are involved in every, and that's something maybe we could talk about once the book has been sold, sort of how we work with editors.
And that's the remaining question, really.
Oh.
Is what
I
want to
go back
that?
And say one
yeah.
more thing about how, because people are often unclear about how the financial piece of this works, but let's say you sell your book for $40,000. So you don't get the money right away. and I take my 15%, and the IRS is going to take theirs, let me tell you. But usually most publishers at this point are splitting your advance payment into four payments. You get a quarter when you sign the contract. And keep in mind, it can take me a month to 2 months to get the contract from their contracts department, negotiate the contract with them, get your signature, get their signature, get the paperwork
routed,
get their request for the signing check, which used to come with the signed contract in the notice, and now come separately. So it could be 3 to 4 months after you have done a deal before you see the first payment. The second payment comes, as we discussed, after your editor formally accepts the manuscript. And just because she emails you that day and says, it's great, we're ready, there's still paperwork. Sometimes it has to go into production. If it's early, sometimes they can.
Nonfiction, they often require all the back matter.
Yes.
Before they accept it. Photographs, captions, permissions.
Index.
Well, if you're indexing, sometimes they will index. And let me just add, for nonfiction, I quite often will get them to change the way they dole out the advance.
Yeah.
Because nonfiction writers quite often
have to do partial delivery.
Right. They also have to do research. I get them more on signing. They have to do research. They have to travel. That costs money, as opposed to a novel, for the most part, isn't going to cost the novelist anything to revise. So that quarter isn't, you know, there are allowances, and you can sort of change the rules. If you make a compelling case, I just did this with Norton, and I thought, I'm going to, you know, it's going to be a fight. And so of course.
Penguin Law really
The Random House, I actually got half And then
recently?
A year ago.
No,
for nonfiction. Now they will. But so anyway, you know, the thing is, my philosophy is, and maybe it's because I'm a Capricorn, is that you can always ask.
Oh, yeah.
And if they say, you should always ask. If they say no, you're in the same place. Like, you haven't lost anything.
But
so
after your acceptance comes the final payment. This comes the third payment, which is usually either on publication, on initial publication, or 12 months after your acceptance. And then the final payment is on paperback publication, which
doesn't always happen
now, and is sometimes anywhere from 6 to 12 months after a hardcover publication, unless you're originally being published in paper. All that's up in the air, but it basically would let you know that money comes in, usually in quarterly installments. Every time it comes in through your agent's office. They take their 15% and then they send it on to you.
Let's also explain for those who may not know what an advance really means. It's advance against...
It's an advance against royalties. So $40,000, and let's say your book is going to be published in hardcover, paperback, and electronic format. So, and your book is priced at $25. So you get the $40,000.
No matter what.
No matter what.
As long as you deliver.
As long as you deliver, then your book is not fraudulent. You never have to pay that money back. Go spend that money. Do what you will. Don't quit your day job. Then for every $25 book that sells, for the first 5,000 copies that sell, $2.50 goes towards that earning out that $40,000. After the first 5,000 copies, the royalty increases to 12.5%, and after 10,000, it increases to 15%, where it stops, and it's 15% forever. So every $2.50, every $2.75, every $3, and then when you're in paperback and you're priced at $16, it's 7.5% of the cover price. Electronic book, it's 25% of net, which is very complicated, so we won't even go there. But basically, you just want to be thinking about like $1, $2, $3, all going to earn out that $40.
Plus subsidiary rights. We need to talk about that.
So all that money, and yes, you're saying to yourself, but I don't understand, like, if the book is $25, like, where is the other $23.50 going?
The thing to say quickly is that in between you writing the book and the person buying it, you're going to hear this said actually a lot over the 2 days, there are many, many parties. And every party is doing it as a job
and that's
gets
paid.
Paid.
Right.
So
and
even the distributor who's driving the book,
they're shipping it,
the design of the book, the typesetting,
the copy editing, the publicity, the marketing.
Art.
The sales,
right.
Everything. And those places have huge pieces of real estate,
right.
Which have huge...
And even the physical real estate of the
yes.
bookstore, they get part of
right.
the sale, of course,
right.
too, because they're selling the book.
Right.
So your $2.50 or your $2.80 all go towards that $40,000. If you only ever make $2,000, that's fine. You still keep your $40,000. If, amazingly, and very, very few books do this, but if amazingly, and you can do the math once you know what your book is, what the jacket price is, you can figure it out, how many copies you need to sell. If you earn enough $2.50 to earn out that $40,000, then those $2.50 start coming to you through us, and we take our 50%, and twice a year, you might get a check, which is an amazing thing, and which is an argument for lower advances, because instead of getting a $200,000 advance once and never earning it out and never seeing any money and maybe not being able to sell your next book because the first book didn't sell any copies, to get a $20,000 advance and have a really nice success and start getting, I don't know, like, you know, you can get a $3,000 check twice a year. You're like, it's free money, dude. It's awesome.
It's icing on the cake.
Yeah.
And then, sorry, I interrupted. In addition to that, you know, the royalty schedule, the 10, 12.5, and 15%, and the straight 7.5 for paperback and the ebook royalty, there's something called subsidiary rights. And sometimes agents will sell those subsidiary rights, which include foreign, or translation, I should say, and UK, and audio rights. And I'm not going to go through all of them. There's a whole host of them, dramatic. And then, you know, if the publisher has those rights, that is included in the royalty statement. So in addition to the $250, if your publisher sells rights to an Italian publisher for $10,000, okay, the publisher will keep 30%, and you will get 70%. So that's 70% of the $10,000 goes towards your advance. I mean, sometimes there are, well, I'm going to say co-agents that sometimes the publishers use. UK, the split is a little different, 80-20, because there's no translation cost. Audio. So there are other ways to make money. You don't have to just rely. Because I think if you just relied on
And by the way, here's another question you might ask your agent. Do you see this as a book that has, you know, legs for foreign sales? Because what's nice about these subsidiary rights is you make hundreds
of money. That's really free money.
The other thing to think about, though, is sometimes I realize, because this is sort of speaking to the understanding of your contract, is that once you sell your book, you are selling a lot of the rights to this book to your publisher. I mean, it is kind of no longer yours. Like, you can't say that, oh, I'd like to take the first chapter and give it to this literary journal. Sorry, they own that. And you can't post a really long excerpt on your website. Sorry, they own that. And you can't record it, and, you know, I mean, you actually, once you have, it's sometimes hard for authors to think about, but when you sell a book, you sell a lot of the rights to that book, to the publisher, and they have the right to do a lot with your work. And it's important to ask your agent, you know, what rights are in this contract, and what can I do with my work down the line, because it can be very limited.
We're actually out of time.
Okay, yeah.
But just to mention that, you know, all contracts are negotiable. They can say no, but if you don't ask, you don't get. Your agent is there to help you.
Yes.
Ask questions. They're a partner with you, one of the many partnerships we're talking about throughout the conference. And, you know, do your homework in identifying and finding an agent, because it's not just finding one, it's finding the right one. Maybe it's one of these two great agents here. Might be the right one for you, might not be. There are many, 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 many agents within two blocks of this office. So, you know, there are lots to choose from. It's really just doing a little homework and identifying them. Look at the books you love first. That's usually the first place to start. And
spend
the agents are generally thanked.
And
spend time on that letter. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.